NPR, and the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Today, we're going to talk about D-Day. And later on, take your phone calls. We'll hear from a veteran of D-Day later on in the program. First, one listener comment about yesterday's program. Yesterday, we were discussing the new travel restrictions for Americans going to Cuba. And after the show, we got this call from one of the people who had called in during the show.
This is Warren. I had called yesterday about supporting a petition to boycott Cuba. And I want to thank your guest, Mr. Montega from La Gazzetta, for helping enlighten me. I now see the error of trying to choke off the tourism industry through the hotels of Havana and see that that will do nothing but hurt the people and not help empower them. So I am going to cancel my petition and perhaps start up a new petition to support a completely open and free tourism to Cuba to help enrich and help supply the means for those people to seek out their own freedom.
A listener comment about yesterday's program where you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Today, there are commemorations marking the 75th anniversary of D-Day. D-Day was the invasion of France by Allied forces, especially English, American, and Canadian forces, as part of the process of ending the Second World War in Europe. It was codenamed Operation Neptune. It aimed to push Nazi Germany out of France. Five beaches in northern France, just across the English Channel from England, codenamed Omaha, Utah, Juneau, Sword and Gold, were the main targets for landing a huge number of troops by air and by sea. At 10 p.m. on June 5th, 1944, troops began departing from British shores to head across the channel. Five assault groups set sail under darkness in an armada of about 7,000 vessels. We're going to hear what Americans heard on the morning, early in the morning, about 3 a.m., heard from CBS, and the initial reports of the invasion. Everything was uncertain. There had been a lot of rumors for weeks. We're going to hear in real time what CBS was telling people who had woken up early on the morning of June 6th here in the U.S., and this is what little they knew. They were getting most of their information not from the American government, but from people who were monitoring the German channels.
CBS World News, Bob Trout speaking, and again we bring you the available report, all of them from German sources, on what the Berlin radio calls the invasion. There is still no Allied confirmation from any source. Correspondents who rushed to the War Department in Washington soon after the first German broadcast was heard were told that our War Department had no information on the German report. There's been no announcement of any sort from Allied headquarters in London. The first news of the German announcement reached this country at 12:37 a.m. Eastern Wartime. The Associated Press recorded this broadcast and immediately pointed out that it could be one which Allied leaders have warned us to expect from the Germans. Shortly after 1 a.m. Eastern Wartime, the Berlin radio opened its news program with a so-called invasion announcement. Columbia Shortwave Listening Station here in New York heard the Berlin radio say, and I quote, "Here is a special bulletin. Early this morning, the long-awaited British and American invasion began when paratroops landed in the area of the Somme estuary. The harbor of Le Havre is being fiercely bombarded at the present moment. Naval forces of the German Navy are off the coast fighting with enemy landing vessels. We've just brought you a special bulletin." End of the quotation. That is the invasion announcement as heard from the Berlin radio by Columbia Shortwave Listening Station. Now here's what Transocean, one of the German news agencies, says, and I quote, "Early Tuesday morning, landing craft and light warships were observed in the area between the mouth of the Somme and the eastern coast of Normandy. At the same time, paratroops were dropped from numerous aircraft on the northern tip of the Normandy Peninsula. It is believed that these paratroops have been given the task of capturing airfields in order to facilitate the landing of further troops. The harbor of Le Havre is at the moment being bombarded. And, continues the broadcast, German naval forces have engaged enemy landing craft off the coast. The transocean broadcast, still unconfirmed, concludes this way. The long-expected Anglo-American invasion appears to have begun. This is the full text of the German transocean broadcast as recorded by the Associated Press. The German broadcasts on the long-expected invasion by the Allies were relayed both to North America and to Germans in the homeland. Germans at home were told by DNB's domestic broadcasts at dawn in Europe. At 1:30 in the morning, Eastern Wartime, the DNB agency repeated the items describing what it called the invasion operation. This was a departure from the usual DNB practice of giving fresh information at that time. The German-controlled Calais radio came on the air today with this announcement in the English language, quote, "This is D-Day. We shall now bring music for the Allied invasion forces." So said the German-controlled Calais radio across the channel from England. Up to this time, almost an hour and a half after the first German broadcast, the United States Office of War Information, whose facilities will be used by American press organizations when Allied armies enter Western Europe, has not transmitted any information at all to support the German claims. Director Elmer Davis of the OWI rushed to his headquarters immediately when OWI officials advised him of the broadcasts from Germany. He told the United Press, "We have no more information than you have. I'll stay here until I find out whether the story is true or not." Last night, Elmer Davis addressed the National Press Club on psychological warfare and showed three motion pictures illustrating how the OWI was propagandizing on the war front. He had just reached his home when his office called him to hurry down. By 1:45 in the morning, Eastern Wartime, almost the entire public relations staff over at the War Department in Washington also had reported for duty. Now, it should be remembered, of course, that the Germans are quite capable of faking this entire series of reports. Their main reason for doing so, in addition to trying to smoke out Allied plans, would be to try to start a premature uprising by the resistance movements along the Channel coast. But the French and the Belgians and the Dutch have all been warned about this possibility repeatedly. And you will recall that Prime Minister Winston Churchill some time ago warned that we could expect false alarms or diversionary feints before the big show began. The British radio, which at 1 a.m. Eastern Wartime sent a warning to residents of the Dutch coast to evacuate inland to a distance of at least 18 miles, might merely have been broadcasting the latest in the series of such warnings that have been given to the civilian populations all along the so-called invasion coast of Europe. No other British report that might indicate that the invasion is on has been released, unless we are to take as significant the report from London half an hour ago that the Royal Air Force was over enemy territory during the night. Even on the enemy side, there are clear reasons for doubting the German report that the invasion has started. The Paris radio at 1 a.m. Eastern Wartime said nothing about any invasion operations in its regular news report. In fact, half an hour after the first German broadcast announcing the landings, one German-controlled Paris radio spokesman said of the war situation, and this is a quotation, "It appears we have been given another month of grace before the invasion will start. A press report from Washington says Roosevelt will come to London at the end of June. Surely this indicates the event will not start before the end of June," said the Paris radio. Well, as I said, there is as yet no reason to believe the German story. Nevertheless, because of high public interest in this country, Columbia is planning to continue overtime operations tonight to all of its affiliate stations until such time as the enemy accounts are proved false or official word from Allied sources is forthcoming. You may listen to this network with assurance that all sources of news will be properly labeled and that we will interrupt programs only with news of exceptional importance and will bring you frequent summaries of all information available. The Columbia Shortwave Listening Station here in New York has heard the British radio report the German announcement of paratroop landings and report the announcement without comment. Then BBC followed that German announcement, which I've already given you, with this, and I quote, Early this morning, people in German-occupied Western Europe received an urgent warning broadcast by a spokesman of the Supreme Command of the Allied Expeditionary Force. It was that a new phase of the Allied air offensive has begun. People living within 22 miles of the coast are particularly affected. The German Overseas News Agency, BBC goes on, has been putting out repeated flashes. Here is one of them. Quote, we have just learned that numerous Allied landing craft and other Allied warships were seen in the area between the Seine estuary and the eastern coast of Normandy. And that was BBC quoting the German report. And now here in the studio with me is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott. And here is Major Elliott now.
We must begin by assuming the, or by understanding the possibility that these German reports may be an outright German lie. We must also take into account the possibility that they may be a series of feints intended to divert the German defense and to draw the German forces to other places than those in which we actually intend to make a serious attack. The report that a new phase of the Allied air offensive has begun, and the consequent request to the inhabitants of Western Europe to clear an area 22 miles from the coast may mean nothing more than an intensification of bombing attacks, or it may indicate the use of paratroops, or it may be, again, a part of the Allied attempt to throw the Germans off their guard. But if we are to accept these German reports as having any value at all, there seems to be some uncertainty as to the location of the Allied landings in France, which they report. It is clear that the Germans are saying that landing craft have been observed approaching the French coast between the eastern shore of what they call the Normandy Peninsula and the mouth of the River Seine, where the port of Le Havre is situated. The Germans are also asserting that this port, Le Havre, is being bombarded, and that Allied paratroops are being landed near the tip of the Normandy Peninsula. What is not clear is the reference made to an Allied landing near the estuary of the River Somme, which is some distance northeast of Le Havre. This may possibly be an error for the Seine estuary, though the actual German translation has been checked several times here in a CBS shortwave listening station. But to analyze all these German statements, what the Germans call the Normandy Peninsula is undoubtedly the Cotentin Peninsula, at the end of which stands the port of Cherbourg. Allied forces would certainly wish, if they were actually landing in France, to obtain a well-equipped seaport as soon as possible, as such a port is essential in order to keep up continuous landings of troops and heavy equipment. We learned at Anzio and elsewhere that it is not safe to leave such matters to the mercy of the weather, as has to be done when dependence is had on open beaches or even small but undeveloped bays. Hence, a double Allied attempt against the two chief ports of northern France, Cherbourg and Le Havre, is well within the possibilities if we are to accept these German reports that landings are taking place at all. From the strategic point of view, there is nothing inconsistent in the report of the landing at the Somme estuary. There is no seaport of importance there, but the Allies might well wish to land on a broad front in order to divert the German defense as much as possible and to keep the Germans from finding out, as long as we could, where the main effort was being made. The landing of paratroops behind the big seaport of Cherbourg would likewise be probable if a landing was really in progress, in order to cut off the movement of German reserves toward that port and thus facilitate its capture by the Allies. But any military analysis must remain fragmentary and uncertain as long as it is based only on German reports, which have so frequently proved to be unreliable in the past.
That was Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott, and I think that brings us up to date to the moment. I'd like to repeat that there is as yet no reason to believe this German story which you have now heard. Nevertheless, because of high public interest in this country, Colombia is planning to continue overtime operations tonight, and I should like to take this opportunity to inform not only you, our audience, but to inform also the staffs on duty at our affiliate stations around the country that Colombia is planning overtime operations until such time as the enemy accounts are proved false or official word from Allied sources is forthcoming. And so, ladies and gentlemen, you may listen to this network with assurance that all sources of news will be properly labeled and that we will interrupt programs only with news of exceptional importance and will bring you frequent summaries of all information available. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
You're listening to a D-Day broadcast on WMNF in Tampa.
It has now been nearly 2 hours since the first German radio announcement that the invasion had begun. Frankly, we don't know at this time whether those German news agency reports that the invasion has begun are true or not. However, the scarcity of any details from the Germans in these 2 hours after the first announcement do throw very strong doubt on the possible truth of the German story. Up until this moment, of course, there's been no confirmation from any Allied source that an invasion may have started. Elmer Davis, director of the Office of War Information, says that he, too, knows nothing of the reports. However, late last night, three German news agencies flashed word that Allied paratroops were spilling out of the skies over the Normandy Peninsula of France, and that our landing craft had started to come ashore in the Le Havre area, just 80 miles across the English Channel from the coast of Britain. The Germans, still without confirmation, say that Allied flyers are pounding Le Havre and its surrounding territory. The German news agency, DNB, also is telling of strong bombing attacks against the Calais and Dunkirk regions of France. Both Calais and Dunkirk lie some 150 miles northeast of Le Havre. This is the way the German Transocean broadcast announced the start of the invasion, and I quote, "The long-awaited invasion," said the Germans, "by the British and Americans, was begun in the first hours of the morning of June 6th. The Germans then go on to say that their naval forces are now engaged in opposing the Allied landings. According to the German DNB agency, no enemy troops have come ashore yet. But again, I repeat, there's absolutely nothing at the moment to substantiate these enemy claims."
Well, that was the first report about the invasion in June, on June 6th, 1944, the D-Day invasion. That was CBS's Bob Trout, who went on to have quite a career at CBS. And as you heard, the CBS network was getting no official confirmation from the U.S. government that the invasion had begun. They were using primarily German sources, people that were monitoring German radio and then reporting back to CBS what they were hearing. And the CBS reporter being very careful, and their military analyst being very careful, they couldn't decide whether this was disinformation or whether it was true, and whether the disinformation was coming from the Germans or somehow being channeled from the Americans to the Germans as a way to throw people off the track. I thought it was interesting where they were talking about an uprising by the resistance fighters in Northern Europe, and especially in France and Belgium. They didn't want that those resistance fighters to rise up prematurely. Very interesting broadcast. Later on in that broadcast, and we're not going to play it, but later on, about a half an hour later, they begin to get confirmation of something going on from Edward R. Murrow, who's over in London at that point, and monitoring his sources there. We're going to talk with a veteran of World War II in just a moment, but I want to also give you an opportunity. What do you think D-Day means to us now, right now, in the year 2019? You can email your thoughts to dj@wmnf.org, and you can also call us up at 813-239-9663. I'm Rob Lori. This is Radioactivity. Well, the what happened was that just after midnight on June 6th, aerial bombardment of enemy positions on the Normandy coast began. That night, more than 5,300 tons of bombs were dropped, Special operations troops were parachuted into the country to attack bridges and secure vital infrastructure targets before the landings. They also sent information about German positions back by pigeon. After anchoring off the coast of France for a couple of hours, U.S. troops landed on Omaha and Utah beaches at about 6:30 a.m. on June 6. About an hour later, Canadian forces landed at Juneau, and British troops landed at Gold and Sword beaches. Those were the code names for the beaches in northern France. U.S. troops faced stiff German resistance at Omaha Beach in particular and were pinned down for several hours. They suffered heavy losses. June 5th had been chosen as the original date of the invasion with the expectation that a full moon, calm waters, and a low tide would aid the landing of troops. But when a storm was forecast, one of the most complex combined air, sea, and land military operations ever to be attempted was delayed for a day, 24 hours, on the advice of weather forecasters. Despite involving a large number of troops, keeping D-Day secret was vital to the success of the operation. A disinformation campaign had led the Germans to believe that Operation Fortitude was the main plan for the Allies to invade the continent via a two-pronged attack involving Norway and Calais. Even once the D-Day landings had begun, German commanders were convinced that they were just a diversionary tactic before the real invasion was to begin. The public had also been kept in the dark until the operation had begun. On the day, at 9 a.m., General Dwight Eisenhower issued a communique announcing that the invasion had begun. That's when the official word got out, 9 a.m. British time. Winston Churchill addressed the House of Commons in London at noon, saying, "So far, the commanders who are engaged report that everything is proceeding according to plan, and what a plan," said Churchill. At 9 p.m., King George addressed the British public in a broadcast describing the operation as the fight to win the final victory for a good cause. By midnight, the Allied forces had full control of the beaches and the push into occupied France had begun. By the end of the day, the Allies had disembarked more than 135,000 men and 10,000 vehicles on the beaches and established bridgeheads of varying depths along the Normandy coastline. This came at the cost of 4,400 Allied troops who were killed, with thousands more injured or missing. There were also heavy casualties among German troops and French civilians. Not everybody landed at the beaches. Some came in by parachute. One of those was former U.S. Congressman Sam Gibbons. Gibbons was a college student, but he left his senior year to join the Army. He was a 24-year-old captain in the 101st Airborne Division on June 6, 1944, the first day of the Allied invasion, and he jumped out of a C-47. Sam Gibbons died a few years ago, but before he died, I spoke with him on a Veterans Day in 2011, and this is my interview with World War II veteran and D-Day veteran Sam Gibbons.
The British Broadcasting Corporation.
Well, it's Veterans Day, Sam, and you're a veteran of World War II. What are your thoughts today on Veterans Day?
Well, thank God I lived through World War II. That's my thought that always is the best. But I realize what our fellow Americans did, and you know they were wonderful. We were citizens in one day, and soldiers the next, and back to citizens a few years later. You know, all of them got special tales.
Now, you were a paratrooper during World War II.
Oh, yeah. I got paid extra. Go ahead. Yes, I volunteered for the parachute troop. I'd had a year or so in the Army, in regular infantry, and I decided I wanted to go to parachute troops, and I went. All of my combat time was spent in parachute troops.
How old were you?
Well, I was, when I invaded Normandy, I was 24 years old. I was an old man. And so I was 24 years old when we invaded Normandy on June the 6th, 1944.
Can you tell us the story of jumping out of the plane and into France on June 6th, 1944?
Sure, I'll be glad to. I can't forget it. You know, blazing in my little memory. The trip across the ocean was a beautiful trip in the plane. We'd been in the air about an hour and a half, getting in formation and getting ready to get to enter the airspace of Europe. And moonlight night, I was sitting in the door of the plane. I was the jump master on that plane, and I looked out across the ocean and thought, what in the hell did I get myself in this mess before? When my better friends are getting married and having a good time, and here I am about to get shot at. Then as we approached France, the anti-aircraft fire broke out, and we had dropped from our altitude of about 2,500 feet down to 800 feet, and you could actually see the people shooting at you sitting in the door where I was, or standing in the door. When the light came on to jump, I knew that I was not in the right place, but I knew that the pilot knew more about the conditions ahead of us, and there had been terrible flying in. We were shot at so much. So my crew jumped, and we jumped maybe 3, 4, maybe 5, 6 miles from our designated place. But most of the jumpers that night were scattered all over the place, and some as far as 25 miles away from where they should have been. But that just confused the hell out of the Germans. They didn't know where we were. Every place they turned, they were running into parachutists. And we weren't that numerous, but we looked fierce and acted fierce. And we got our job done.
Now, when you jumped out of the plane, where did you land?
Well, I landed at on the main highway between Paris and Cherbourg, France. Cherbourg at that time was France's biggest port. And then I landed on a crossroads, and I landed about 60 feet away from 15 Germans shooting in the air. I thought they were shooting at me, but actually they were shooting at the airplanes. And when you shoot a gun at night, I finally learned that night, you create a huge blast in front of you, bright flash. And it will, if you shoot enough times, it'll night blind you. And they were well night blinded. They were making so much noise they couldn't hit me. They couldn't hear me or see me when I came down real near them. And I was able to get away from them after crawling across the field and sticking my hand into a warm cow pie. I began to pick up American soldiers. By about 3 o'clock in the morning, I had about 50 American soldiers under my direction, and we took off for our objective, which was to control a river bridge about a mile long and over a river that was very important in a whole tactical situation.
And did most of the men who jumped from the plane, did most of them survive?
You know, I don't know. I lost track of the two men that were right behind me. I don't know whether they came down right in the middle of the Germans, and I came down about 60 yards from the Germans. I know that some of them survived, and I picked up some of them on the ground that night, and we formed a combat team in which I was the senior officer. And we fought all day, and finally we got, after about a day and a half, we finally found the rest of our unit and joined up into our regimental combat team. We were badly disseminated, decimated. We were down to about, maybe 30% strength of what we had entered the Air Force, entered the planes with. Some of them turned up from as far as 15 miles away.
Wow. Now,
they were lucky. Most of them didn't.
Now, there's a story about you and a I think it's a can of beer or a bottle of beer.
Well, let me tell you about the beer. Just before the invasion started, the high command said, "You're going to get the cruiser Quincy to support you." Well, they drove up from where they were in port, and their crew that was we were going to be working with, the liaison, and I was in charge of that detail. We had to cross train with the cruiser Quincy's fire control folks and our mortar fire control folks. They spoke a slightly different lingo, but after about 4 or 5 days of training, everybody said, "Well, we can make it." And the Navy fellows were so nice. They said, "Well, Captain, what can we do for you?" I said, "Well, at this stage of the game, not much." So they went over to the little Jeep and pulled off a whole carton of beer in cans, Schlitz beer, and gave it to me. And I took it to my hole in the ground where I was sleeping, and the fellows around me, I shared it with them until the invasion started. When the invasion started, I had 2 cans left. And I stuck them in my gas mask, and I jumped into Normandy with 2 cans of Schlitz beer. About 10 o'clock on the morning of D-Day, I called a little halt in my combat patrol and beckoned the fellows who were near me, come over and we'll split the 2 cans of Schlitz beer. And so about 4 of us drank 2 cans of Schlitz beer about 10 o'clock in the morning on the main highway between Paris and Cherbourg. We stacked the cans in the middle of the highway because, you know, and we didn't want to trash the place. I had to come back that way that afternoon, and the cans were gone. So I don't know what happened to empty cans, but when I went over there as the president's representative 50 years later, President Clinton gave me 2 cans of Schlitz beer, and I took them back, and my family and I stood in the same place, same time of day, and drank 2 cans of beer together. Lord.
After all the tension, I mean, you must have been scared to death. After all the tension, what was it like to have a beer there on the road?
Well, you know, I just shared it with about 4 people, 2 cans. And I didn't feel much. I didn't want to get drunk, good Lord. I had a lot of responsibility. So I don't remember feeling anything. It was just wet and good. I wish I'd had 4 cans.
So, Sam, these days, a lot of veterans have returned from Vietnam. They've returned from Iraq and Afghanistan. And where you live in South Tampa and all over the Bay Area, you see men, mostly men, on the roadside holding these signs that say, "Homeless veteran." And I'm just wondering,
Many of them are. Now, we pride ourselves on our veteran program as a country, but frankly, there are a lot of holes in it. And war does, the stress of war, and it is a very stressful occupation, leaves people in different conditions. And these people are ones, generally speaking, who have some kind of combat fatigue-related condition. We could see it in World War II. We had suicides. We had self-meaning. It shocked us when it first started, but a lot of guys just couldn't stand for one reason or another. Maybe their combat had been so intensive that it broke. Maybe the anticipation of combat, all those kind of things. We've got a lot of veterans who are injured mentally and just can't make it. And we've been slow to identify them and slower yet to treat them. But uh, we we've got some excellent programs, but not everybody gets in them.
Well, that was Sam Gibbons, the former congressman from Tampa, who was a D-Day veteran. As you heard, he parachuted into northern France, and his mission was to secure a bridge. He survived the landing and avoided the shooting of the German soldiers. Sam Gibbons died in 2012. That interview was done about 6 months or so before he died on Veterans Day. Gibbons helped inspired Tom Brokaw to write that book, The Greatest Generation. They met in a French cafe on the 40th anniversary of the D-Day invasion, and Brokaw said he was mesmerized by Sam Gibbons' stories and went on to write that book, The Greatest Generation. Well, today is the anniversary of D-Day, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. And what do you think lessons should we learn from D-Day? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. Imad writes this about D-Day. He said, I'm the son of one of those guys that went over there and his war bride. My parents never spoke of the atrocities and horrors that they witnessed. I learned of that later. That this president, President Trump, who has spent his term unraveling all they fought and died for and has promoted his own Aryan principles and is without honor and valor, was permitted to speak at the event commemorating their victory, honor and valor. Did all those who fought and died there a great disservice, writes Imad. David writes this, thanks so much for playing the old radio news coverage of the D-Day invasion. Very interesting, and I haven't heard this before. I wonder how the nonstop cable news cycle would have covered this. Probably Fox News would get Hannity to spread mistruths about the invasion, and Alex Jones would be foaming at the mouth about this being a false flag or PSYOP activity, writes David. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. What does D-Day mean to you? What lessons have we learned? And what's your takeaway from everything that maybe you've watched some of the TV coverage? Maybe you've heard some of the coverage on our headline news. Maybe you've read the newspaper this morning or the newspapers. Maybe you've been online. What do you think the takeaway from D-Day is for you? Again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Gray writes this tongue-in-cheek. Gray writes, obviously, that news report you played from CBS was just an attempt by fake news CBS to insult the good name of the very fine people in Berlin, writes Gray. And Charles writes this, in my profession, I do many interesting seafloor mapping projects, and one of those projects was the mapping of the wrecks of D-Day. This was a joint U.S.-French-British project to create a baseline of the remaining underwater wrecks and to produce various documentaries for television to coincide with the 70th anniversary of D-Day. This was a NOVA presentation on CBS, and he says that you can find some of the images of the wrecks by going to a website. And really, that website is way too far, way too much to read. Sorry about that. But Charles goes on to say, as a side note, my father was at Normandy. He actually landed a few days before D-Day in the first of the Waco gliders as part of a small AAF group. And Charles, thank you for that. Again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. Bubba writes this, Dunkirk was a great movie. Very brave men and women, military and civilian. We've gotten soft, writes Bubba. D-Day was done on the 44th anniversary of the evacuation of Dunkirk. And Sid in Tampa says, this is a great story from Sam Gibbons about the Schlitz beer. I was laughing pretty hard. Brokaw did pick the right title for them and his book, of course. I am biased as my dad was a member of the Greatest Generation, says Sid in Tampa. Let's go to the phones. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. And Bill Grace is our phone producer today. Let's go to Jim in South Tampa. Jim, thanks. What are your thoughts about D-Day?
Well, my thoughts are I wish just for one day we could drop the politics and honor those kids. And they were just kids who they had never seen combat before. And here they were giving their lives on that beach. And I just wish, like I said, we could just drop the politics and the innuendo. And let's just be thankful that we had people back then with enough guts, patriotism, and sense of duty that they would do that. And it was a righteous cause because we had pure evil in Nazi Germany that it had to be dealt with. And I'm just thankful that we had enough Americans and had enough sense of duty and knew what needed to be done, and they did it, and they died. And it wasn't just on D-Day. That was the beginning of Overlord. Once they got in off those beaches, they found themselves in the Bocage area. That was a killing field, and it was a slugfest. And just because they survived D-Day, it was by no means over. So I'm today just thankful for those kids, those 18, 19, 20-year-old kids who were able to do that and beat the big Hitler giant Nazi machine. That's all I got to say.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot. Thanks for your phone call, and we're getting your thoughts about D-Day today. Let's go to Sean in Tampa. Sean, what are your thoughts on D-Day?
Yeah, I totally agree with Jim, and thank you for taking my call. You know, the biggest thing that I take away from D-Day is the fact that not only a nation, but half the world came together, and they did something that was spectacular. They pretty much got rid of Germany and started a new way of life. I'm a vet. I retired last year. And, I mean, like Jim was saying, I mean, those are young kids that went through hell and back. And they came home and they lived lives and they built what we have today. And we have to be thankful for that. Is it perfect? No. And we all know that. But it's proof that humanity could succeed and we could all work together for a common goal. That's all I got to say.
All right. Sean, thanks a lot. Thanks for your comments. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. The country was split before World War II. There were some people that saw the dangers of fascism in Europe, and they went to fight it in France when Franco was trying to overthrow the democratically elected government. And people in this country were split. Lindbergh was saying that we shouldn't get involved in the war in Europe. People that fought in the war against Franco were considered to be premature anti-fascists. And at one point, the Nazis rallied in New York just about before the start of the war and got 20,000 people to Madison Square Garden. So this country was not completely united in 1941 at the start of the war. I think at the end, it came to see what the dangers of fascism were. But I think there were splits along the way leading up to this. Let's go to Andy in Dunedin. Andy, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob. Happy Thursday. Yeah, I was in the Air Force myself, and sometimes it irks me when people that never served have so much to say about it. I don't know that we've learned a lot. One of the things that's helped us over here is having a big ocean on either side of the country to deter anybody coming over here. So we've never had anything, you know, really go down on our soil the way things did in Europe. And that's why our steel industry was so big post-war, is because theirs was totally decimated. But people also need to remember that it wasn't just Americans over there fighting. We had Canada lost a lot of people there on D-Day too. And, you know, my hat's off to all those veterans. I mean, they actually did fight for our freedom and the freedom of many people. And ever since then, any other war that we've gotten into has had nothing to do with our freedom, although they will tell you that time and time again that we're fighting for our freedom. But World War II was it. That was the big one, and hopefully we won't ever have to go through something like that again.
All right, Andy, thanks a lot. Thanks. Yeah, but Canada lost a lot of people. America lost a lot of people. England lost a lot of people. And I think there were people also from the Allied countries. Part of the British Empire joined in. I know there were pilots from other countries, part of the British Empire, who came to England and helped fight the Nazis. But 4,400 Allied troops died just on this day alone, on the day of the invasion, June 6, 1944. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Our email address, dj@wmnf.org. Let's go to Susan on Anna Marie Island. Susan, what would you like to say about D-Day?
Hi, Rob. That was a great interview. I mean, it almost brought me to tears. That's a true patriotism, true heroism. And I can't imagine, you know, with the adrenaline and what's going through your mind, because you know you have to do this. And I did laugh though when he said something to something like what the hell am I doing here, you know?
Yeah, you know, I got to say, I didn't laugh, but there were so many funny lines, and I was just trying to get Sam on tape because I didn't want to interrupt what he said with my laughter. But he was very humorous through that whole interview, even though it was a matter of life and death.
Absolutely. And, you know, he walks the walk. I mean, those are, like I said, true patriots. And we just have people that, like the person ahead of me said, you know, they just talk, and they have no idea. I mean, I can't imagine, like, what went through his head. I remember being in Korea and having an alert at 3 in the morning. We had to get our equipment and everything. We had no idea what was going on, but I remember my emotions. But it was nothing like that where we didn't know what was going on, and probably nothing, which it was nothing. It was just an exercise. But he knew he was coming into some, you know, something serious. And you just, I don't know, I can't even imagine. But real quick, I wanted to comment. I forget what the gentleman's name was on the Cuba where he did the petition.
Yeah, Juan.
And he called in.
Yeah, his name was Juan.
Yeah, Juan called in at the top of the hour. I wanted to commend him. This is what we really need. I mean, some people would refer to him as a flip-flopper. But this gentleman listened to the show, listened to people, and changed his opinion. You know, he reevaluated the information and changed his opinion. And I commend him for that, and I wanted to thank him, and I hope he's listening.
All right. Susan, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Rob.
Thanks, and great to hear from you. 813-239-9663. Asking our listeners what their thoughts are on D-Day. What does D-Day mean to you now as somebody who's living in 2019? What lessons have we learned? Well, let's go to Gary in Sarasota. Gary, thanks for calling WMNF. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob. Great subject today and well-deserved. I just wanted to remind some of the folks out there that after D-Day and after some of those soldiers made it all the way to Berlin, they're like, wow, we got them beat, and then they shipped them over to Japan. I mean, the war wasn't over. World War II was not over. Then they still had to fight. They went on for another year, you know. That's tough, huh?
Oh, yeah. Well, some of the guys who were in D-Day in the D-Day invasion had just landed in Italy. They had just taken Rome on the day that the D-Day invasion started. Some of those troops were fresh from Rome, and then they were going over to, they were going to invade, you know, a horrific time invading Normandy. So yeah, it was tough. And then some of the guys have been in North Africa before that. So they went to North Africa, then they went to Italy, and then it was their third invasion. Then they went to Normandy.
You know, a lot of people also don't realize that the Russians lost 20 million people.
Yeah, I don't think the Russians get enough credit. We always think that it was us, but even stupid shows like Hogan's Heroes pointed out that the Russian front was horrific, and that was where most of the lives were lost on both sides, on the German side and the Russian side.
Well, Stalin used to say that, yes, you Americans, you're going to let us fight to the last Russian before you get involved, because he kept saying, help me, help me, help me. But we did provide them a lot of mechanized armor and equipment, so...
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, we were only in that war for a year. But then don't forget Japan, man, was right after Okinawa. The Japanese lost 90,000 people in 10 days, 90,000 soldiers in 10 days in Okinawa.
That's amazing. Yeah. All right.
Oh,
okay.
No.
Thanks a lot. Okay. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. We're talking about D-Day and getting your thoughts about D-Day. We're going to go back to the phones in just a second. I'll read some of these emails, though. Elena from Lakeland writes, my dad, too, was in the 101st and at Normandy. He never talked about it other than to say that those boys were sent to invade with an expected 80% death rate. Dad was field promoted to sergeant at age 18 as a result of a loss of soldiers. As a previous caller mentioned, these were indeed kids. I would like us to remember that there's a whole lot more blood and guts than glory in these kind of actions. We should spend all of our efforts to avoid war, writes Elena. Yeah, my dad was in the Army Air Force and stationed in southern England, and was getting the planes ready parachute in and send bombs over France. And he was part of the D-Day prep. I always talked about that. But, you know, if a war movie came on TV or if a World War II TV show came on, he couldn't look at it. And he hated war. Because of his experience in southern France, because his base was bombed by the Germans. And one of my dad's jobs as being in the Army Air Force at the base was to go around and pick up body parts of his fellow soldiers who were killed in the bombing. And he actually used a wheelbarrow to do that. And I think that turned my dad off to war entirely. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Let's go to Charlotte in St. Pete. Hi, Charlotte. D-Day.
Hi there, Rob. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I just want to make a few comments, not specifically about D-Day, except for the end. I was born in Los Angeles, so we were there in L.A., and my mom worked for Lockheed, and her name was Rosalie, and she was literally Rosie the Riveter.
Wow.
Doing, you know, making planes.
Yeah, so many women were involved in the war effort, yeah.
Yeah, and so we had the black curtains on the windows and everything. But then we moved to San Bernardino inland, and we lived a block over from Route, we called it Mount Vernon Avenue, but it was Route 66, and we could see the convoys. We'd run up to that street and see the convoys coming in on the last leg into L.A. to ship out. And I have a picture of three cousins. Sorry. Military, you know, that shipped over, but they all came back. And my grandson was in the 101st Airborne, two tours in Iraq, so I got a lot of military in the family. But, so D-Day came in San Bernardino. We all rushed out. We were banging on tin wash tubs. Everyone just poured out in the streets, you know.
Because you were so happy?
We were so happy that it was over. I just wanted to share that.
Well, Charlotte, thank you. Thank you for your remembrances of... of D-Day. So, but your cousins who went over, they survived.
They all came back.
Yeah.
They all came back. We're all from, my family's all from New Mexico when we all moved to California. Well, some of them, us did. But there, I have a picture. One was in the Navy. He was one of those deep sea divers that had to go down and recover bodies. I remember my mother telling me about that. And then I think the other two were Army. But San Bernardino had two Air Force bases, March and Norton. So there was a lot of military action in San Bernardino.
Yeah, and a big part of the war, the war building effort where planes were being made and all throughout Southern California for the war effort.
Right, and like I said, I always joked that my mom was, and she looked just like the poster, the coveralls and the bandana on her head, you know, just like the poster.
Yeah, and taking women out of the factories after 1945, that was a big issue, and we'll talk about that. I know the women's show has been talking about that.
Yeah.
Charlotte, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Charlotte. I know that was tough. Well, if you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115, and I'll play your comments back tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Thanks to Bill Grace. He's been our phone producer today. One of the top chefs in the Tampa Bay area is coming up live next on WMNF in Tampa. She'll be on the Midpoint program with Lynn and Shelley. Jeannie Parola will be here. She is the chef at Edison in downtown Tampa, and we'll hear more about that, what it's like to be a top chef, coming up next right here on WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg.